For a moment, he was not sure whether he meant the Aes Sedai or the Tinker Woman, who seemed to be taking her own time. If she kept on as she was, the woman would pass a good 30 paces to one side of the thicket. With her eyes fixed on where her piebald stepped, she gave no sign that she had seen them among the trees. Perrin nudged the stallion's flanks with his heels, and the dun leaped ahead, sending up sprays of snow with his hooves. Behind him, Uno quietly gave the command,
"Forward!"
Stepper was halfway to her before she seemed to become aware of them, and then she jerked her mare to a halt with a start. She watched as they formed an arc centered on her. Embroidery of eye-wrenching blue and the pattern called a Tyran maze made her red cloak even more garish. She was not young. Gray showed thick in her hair, where it was not hidden by her cowl. But her face had few lines, other than the disapproving frown she ran over their weapons. If she was alarmed at meeting armed men in the heart of mountain wilderness, though, she gave no sign. Her hands rested easily on the high pommel of her worn but well-kept saddle. And she did not smell afraid.
"Stop that," Perrin told himself.
He made his voice soft so as not to frighten her.
"My name is Perrin, good mistress. If you need help, I will do what I can. If not, go with the light. But unless the Tuathawan have changed their ways, you are far from your wagons."
She studied them a moment more before speaking. There was a gentleness in her dark eyes, not surprising in one of the traveling people.
"I seek a woman."
The skip was small, but it was there. She sought not any woman, but an Aes Sedai.
"Does she have a name, good mistress?" Perrin asked.
He had done this too many times in the last few months to need her reply, but iron was spoiled for want of care.
"She is called... sometimes she is called Moraine. My name is Leah."
Perrin nodded. "We will take you to her, Mistress Leah. We have warm fires, and with luck, something hot to eat." But he did not lift his reins immediately. "How did you find us?" He had asked before, each time Moraine sent him out to wait at a spot she named, for a woman she knew would come. The answer would be the same as it always was, but he had to ask. Leah shrugged and answered hesitantly.
"I knew that if I came this way, someone would find me and take me to her. I just knew. I have news for her."
Perrin did not ask what news. The women gave the information they brought only to Moraine.
"And the Aes Sedai tells us what she chooses," he thought.
Aes Sedai never lied. But it was said that the truth an Aes Sedai told you was not always the truth you thought it was.
"Too late for qualms now, isn't it?"
"This way, Mistress Leah," he said, gesturing up the mountain.
The Shinarans, with Uno at their head, fell in behind Perrin and Leah as they began to climb. The Borderlanders still studied the sky as much as the land, and the last two kept a special watch on their back trail. For a time they rode in silence except for the sound the horses' hooves made, sometimes crunching through old snow crust, sometimes sending rocks clattering as they crossed bare stretches. Now and again, Leah cast glances at Perrin, at his bow, his axe, his face. But she did not speak. He shifted uncomfortably under the scrutiny and avoided looking at her. He always tried to give strangers as little chance to notice his eyes as he could manage. Finally he said,
"I was surprised to see one of the traveling people believing as you do."
"It is possible to oppose evil without doing violence."
Her voice held the simplicity of someone stating an obvious truth. Perrin grunted sourly, then immediately muttered an apology.
"Would it were as you say, Mistress Leah."
"Violence harms the doer as much as the victim," Leah said placidly. "That is why we flee those who harm us, to save them from harm to themselves, as much for our own safety. If we do violence to oppose evil, soon we would be no different from what we struggle against. It is with the strength of our belief that we fight the shadow."
Perrin could not help snorting.
"Mistress, I hope you never have to face Trollocs with the strength of your belief.
The strength of their swords will cut you down where you stand.
It is better to die than to...
She began, but anger made him speak right over her. Anger that she just would not see. Anger that she really would die, rather than harm anyone, no matter how evil.
If you run, they will hunt you and kill you and eat your corpse. Or they might not wait till it is a corpse. Either way, you are dead, and it's evil that has won. And there are men just as cruel. Dark friends and others. More others than I would have believed even a year ago.
Let the white cloaks decide you tinkers don't walk in the light, and see how many of you the strength of your belief can keep alive.
She gave him a penetrating look.
And yet you are not happy with your weapons.
How did she know that? He shook his head irritably, shaggy hair swaying.
The Creator made the world, he muttered, not I. I must live the best I can in the world the way it is.
So sad for one so young, she said softly. Why so sad?
I should be watching, not talking, he said curtly. You won't thank me if I get you lost.
He heeled Stepper forward enough to cut off any further conversation, but he could feel her looking at him.
Sad? I'm not sad, just...
Light, I don't know. There ought to be a better way, that's all.
The itching tickle came again at the back of his head, but absorbed in ignoring Leah's eyes on his back, he ignored that too. Over the slope of the mountain and down they rode, across a forested valley with a broad stream running cold along its bottom, knee-deep on the horses. In the distance, the side of a mountain had been carved into the semblance of two towering forms, a man and a woman, Perrin thought they might be, though wind and rain had long since made that uncertain. Even Moraine claimed to be unsure who they were supposed to be or when the granite had been cut. Pricklebacks and small trout darted away from the horses' hooves, silver flashes in the clear water. A deer raised its head from browsing, hesitated as the party rode up out of the stream, then bounded off into the trees, and a large mountain cat, gray-striped and spotted with black, seemed to rise out of the ground, frustrated in its stalk. It eyed the horses a moment, and with a lash of its tail, vanished after the deer. But there was little life visible in the mountains yet. Only a handful of birds perched on limbs or pecked at the ground where the snow had melted. More would return to the heights in a few weeks, but not yet. They saw no other ravens. It was late afternoon by the time Perrin led them between two steep-sloped mountains, snowy peaks as ever wrapped in cloud, and turned up a smaller stream that splashed downward over gray stones in a series of tiny waterfalls. A bird called in the trees, and another answered it from ahead. Perrin smiled. Bluefinch calls. A borderland bird. No one rode this way without being seen. He rubbed his nose and did not look at the tree the first bird had called from. Their path narrowed as they rode up through scrubby leatherleaf and a few gnarled mountain oaks. The ground, level enough to ride beside the stream, became barely wider than a man on horseback, and the stream itself, no more than a tall man could step across. Perrin heard Leah behind him, murmuring to herself. When he looked over his shoulder, she was casting worried glances up the steep slopes to either side. Scattered trees perched precariously above them. It appeared impossible they would not fall. The Shinarans rode easily, at last beginning to relax. Abruptly, a deep oval bowl between the mountains opened out before them, its sides steep but not nearly so precipitous as the narrow passage. The stream rose from a small spring at its far end. Perrin's sharp eyes picked out a man with the top knot of a Shinaran up in the limbs of an oak to his left. Had a red-winged jay called instead of a bluefinch, he would not have been alone, and the way in would not have been so easy. A handful of men could hold that passage against an army. If an army came, a handful would have to. Among the trees around the bowl stood log huts, not readily visible, so that those gathered around the cook fires at the bottom of the bowl seemed at first to be without shelter. There were fewer than a dozen in sight, and not many more out of sight, Perrin knew. Most of them looked around at the sound of horses, and some waved. The bowl seemed filled with the smells of men and horses, of cooking and burning wood. A long white banner hung limply from a tall pole near them. One form, at least half again as tall as anyone else, sat on a log engrossed in a book that was small in his huge hands. That one's attention never wavered, even when the only other person without a topknot shouted,
"So you found her, did you? I thought you'd be gone the night this time."
It was a young woman's voice, but she wore a boy's coat and breeches and had her hair cut short. A burst of wind swirled into the bowl, making cloaks flap and rippling the banner out to its full length. For a moment, the creature on it seemed to ride the wind. A four-legged serpent scaled in gold and scarlet, golden-maned like a lion, and its feet each tipped with five golden claws. A banner of legend. A banner most men would not know if they saw it, but would fear when they learned its name. Perrin waved a hand that took it all in as he led the way down into the bowl. "Welcome to the camp of the Dragon Reborn, Leah." Chapter 2. Saidin. Face expressionless, the Tuathawan woman stared at the banner as it drooped again, then turned her attention to those around the fire, especially the one reading, the one half again as tall as Perrin and twice as big.
"You have an Ogier with you. I would not have thought..."
She shook her head.
"Where is Moraine Sedai?"
It seemed the dragon banner might as well not exist as far as she was concerned. Perrin gestured toward the rough hut that stood furthest up the slope at the far end of the bowl. With walls and sloping roof of unpeeled logs, it was the largest, though not very big at that. Perhaps just barely large enough to be called a cabin rather than a hut. "That one is hers. Hers and Lan's. He is her warder. When you have had something hot to drink..."
"No. I must speak to Moraine."
He was not surprised. All the women who came insisted on speaking to Moraine immediately and alone. The news that Moraine chose to share with the rest of them did not always seem very important, but the women held the intensity of a hunter stalking the last rabbit in the world for his starving family. The half-frozen old beggar woman had refused blankets and a plate of hot stew and tramped up to Moraine's hut, barefoot and still falling snow. Leah slid from her saddle and handed the reins up to Perrin.
"Will you see that she is fed?"
She patted the piebald mare's nose.
"Pisa is not used to carrying me over such rugged country."
"Fodder is scarce still," Perrin told her, "but she'll have what we can give her."
Leah nodded and went hurrying away up the slope without another word, holding her bright green skirts up, the blue-embroidered red cloak swaying behind her. Perrin swung down from his saddle, exchanging a few words with the men who came from the fires to take the horses. He gave his bow to the one who took stepper. No, except for one raven, they had seen nothing but the mountains and the Tuathawan woman. Yes, the raven was dead. No, she had told them nothing of what was happening outside the mountains. No, he had no idea whether they would be leaving soon.
"Or ever,"
he added to himself. Moraine had kept them there all winter. The Shinarans did not think she gave the orders, not here, but Perrin knew that Aes Sedai somehow always seemed to get their way, especially Moraine. Once the horses were led away to the rude log stable, the riders went to warm themselves. Perrin tossed his cloak back over his shoulders and held his hands out to the flames gratefully. The big kettle, Berlon work by the look of it, gave off smells that had been making his mouth water for some time already. Someone had been lucky hunting today, it seemed, and lumpy roots circled another fire close by, giving off an aroma faintly like turnips as they roasted. He wrinkled his nose and concentrated on the stew. More and more he wanted meat above anything else. The woman in men's clothes was peering toward Leah, who was just disappearing into Moraine's hut.
"What do you see, men?" he asked.
She came to stand beside him, her dark eyes troubled. He did not understand why she insisted on breeches instead of skirts. Perhaps it was because he knew her, but he could not see how anyone could look at her and see a too handsome youth instead of a pretty young woman.
"The tinker woman is going to die," she said softly, eyeing the others near the fires.
None was close enough to hear. He was still thinking of Leah's gentle face.
Ah, light. Tinkers never harm anyone.
He felt cold despite the warmth of the fire.
Burn me, I wish I'd never asked.
Even the few Aes Sedai who knew of it did not understand what Min did. Sometimes she saw images and auras surrounding people, and sometimes she even knew what they meant. Masuto came to stir the stew with a long wooden spoon. The Shinaran eyed them, then laid a finger alongside his long nose and grinned widely before he left.
Blood and ashes, Min muttered. He's probably decided we are sweethearts murmuring to each other by the fire.
Are you sure? Perrin asked. She raised her eyebrows at him, and he hastily added,
About Leah. Is that her name? I wish I didn't know. It always makes it worse, knowing and not being able to... Perrin, I saw her own face floating over her shoulder, covered in blood, eyes staring. It's never any clearer than that.
She shivered and rubbed her hands together briskly.
Light, but I wish I saw more happy things. All the happy things seem to have gone away.
He opened his mouth to suggest warning Leah, then closed it again. There was never any doubt about what Min saw and knew, for good or bad. If she was certain, it happened.
Blood on her face, he muttered. Does that mean she'll die by violence?
He winced that he said it so easily.
But what can I do? If I tell Leah, if I make her believe somehow, she'll live her last days in fear, and it will change nothing.
Min gave a short nod.
If she's going to die by violence, it could mean an attack on the camp.
But there were scouts out every day, and guards set day and night, and Moraine had the camp warded, so she said. No creature of the Dark One would see it unless he walked right into it. He thought of the wolves.
No.
The scouts would find anyone or anything trying to approach the camp.
It's a long way back to her people, he said half to himself. Tinkers wouldn't have brought their wagons any further than the foothills. Anything could happen between here and there.
Min nodded sadly.
And there aren't enough of us to spare even one guard for her, even if it would do any good.
She had told him. She had tried warning people about bad things when, at 6 or 7, she had first realized not everyone could see what she saw. She would not say more, but he had the impression that her warnings had only made matters worse when they were believed at all. It took some doing to believe in Min's viewings until you had proof.
When, he said.
The word was cold in his ears and hard as tool steel.
I can't do anything about Leah, but maybe I can figure out whether we're going to be attacked.
As soon as the word was out of his mouth, she threw up her hands. She kept her voice down, though.
It isn't like that. I can never tell when something is going to happen. I only know it will. If I even know what I see means. You don't understand. The seeing doesn't come when I want it to, and neither does knowing. It just happens, and sometimes I know. Something. A little bit. It just happens.
He tried to get a soothing word in, but she was letting it all out in a flood he could not stem.
I can see things around a man one day and not the next, or the other way round. Most of the time I don't see anything around anyone. Aes Sedai always have images around them, of course, and warders, though it's always harder to say what it means with them than with anyone else.
She gave Perrin a searching look, half squinting.
A few others always do, too.
Don't tell me what you see when you look at me, he said harshly,
then shrugged his heavy shoulders. Even as a child, he had been bigger than most of the others, and he had quickly learned how easy it was to hurt people by accident when you were bigger than they. It had made him cautious and careful and regretful of his anger when he let it show.
I am sorry, Min. I shouldn't have snapped at you. I did not mean to hurt you.
She gave him a surprised look.
You didn't hurt me. Blessed few people want to know what I see. The light knows I would not, if it were someone else who could do it.
Even the Aes Sedai had never heard of anyone else who had her gift. Gift was how they saw it, even if she did not.
It's just that I wish there was something I could do about Leah. I couldn't stand it the way you do, knowing and not able to do anything. Strange, she said softly. How you seem to care so much about the Tuathuan. They are utterly peaceful, and I always see violence around.
He turned his head away, and she cut off abruptly.
To Othoan?
Came a rumbling voice like a huge bumblebee.
What about the Two Othoan?
The Ogier came to join them at the fire, marking his place in his book with a finger the size of a large sausage. A thin streamer of tobacco smoke rose from the pipe in his other hand. His high-necked coat of dark brown wool, buttoned up to the neck and flared at the knee, overturned down boot tops. Perrin stood hardly as high as his chest. Loyal's face had frightened more than one person, with his nose broad enough almost to be called a snout and his too wide mouth. His eyes were the size of saucers, with thick eyebrows that dangled like mustaches almost to his cheeks, and his ears poked up through long hair and tufted points. Some who had never seen an Ogier took him for a Trolloc, though Trollocs were as much legend to most of them as Ogier. Loyal's wide smile wavered, and his eyes blinked as he became aware of having interrupted them. Perrin wondered how anyone could be frightened of the Ogier for long. Yet some of the old stories call them fierce and implacable as enemies. He could not believe it. Ogier were enemies to no one. Min told Loyal of Leah's arrival, but not of what she had seen. She was usually close-mouthed about these seeings, especially when they were bad. Instead, she added, "You should know how I feel, Loyal, suddenly caught up by Aes Sedai and these two rivers folk." Loyal made a noncommittal sound, but Min seemed to take it for agreement.
"Yes," she said emphatically. "There I was, living my life in Berlon as I liked it, when suddenly I was grabbed up by the scruff of the neck and jerked off to the light knows where. Well, I might as well have been. My life has not been my own since I met Moraine. And these Two Rivers farm boys."
She rolled her eyes at Perrin, a wry twist to her mouth.
"All I wanted was to live as I pleased, fall in love with the man I chose."
Her cheeks reddened suddenly, and she cleared her throat.
"I mean to say, what is wrong with wanting to live your life without all this upheaval?"
"Tarviren,"
Loyal began. Perrin waved at him to stop, but the Ogier could seldom be slowed, much less stopped, when one of his enthusiasms had him in its grip. He was accounted extremely hasty by the Ogier way of looking at things. Loyal pushed his book into a coat pocket and went on, gesturing with his pipe.
"All of us, all of our lives, affect the lives of others, Min. As the wheel of time weaves us into the pattern, the life thread of each of us pulls and tugs at the life threads around us. Tarviren are the same, only much, much more so. They tug at the entire pattern, for a time at least, forcing it to shape around them. The closer you are to them, the more you are affected personally. It's said that if you were in the same room with Utter Hawkwing, you could feel the pattern rearranging itself. I don't know how that is true, but I've read that it was. But it doesn't only work one way. Tarviren themselves are woven to a tighter line than the rest of us, with fewer choices."
Perrin grimaced. "Bloody few of the ones that matter." Min tossed her head.
"I just wish they didn't have to be so bloody Tarviren all the time. Tarviren tugging on one side and Aes Sedai meddling on the other? What chance does a woman have?"
Loyal shrugged.
"Very little, I suppose, as long as she stays close to Tarviren."
"As if I had a choice," Min growled.
"It was your good fortune, or misfortune, if you see it that way, to fall in with not one but three Tarviren. Rand, Matt, and Perrin. I myself count it very good fortune, and would even if they weren't my friends. I think I might even—"
The Ogier looked at them, suddenly shy, his ears twitching.
"Promise you will not laugh. I think I might write a book about it. I have been taking notes."
Min smiled, a friendly smile, and Loyal's ears pricked back up again.
"That's wonderful," she told him. "But some of us feel as if we're being danced about like puppets by these Tarviren."
"I didn't ask for it," Perrin burst out. "I did not ask for it."
She ignored him.
"Is that what happened to you, Loyal? Is that why you travel with Moraine? I know you Ogier almost never leave your steading. Did one of these Tarviren tug you along with him?"
Loyal became engrossed in a study of his pipe.
"I just wanted to see the groves the Ogier planted,"
he muttered.
"Just to see the groves."
He glanced at Perrin as if asking for help, but Perrin only grinned. Let's see how the shoe nails onto your hoof. He did not know all of it, but he did know Loyal had run away. He was 90 years old, but not yet old enough by Ogier standards to leave the steading. Going outside, they called it, without the permission of the elders. Ogier lived a very long time, as humans saw things. Loyal said the elders would not be best pleased when they put their hands on him again. He seemed intent on putting that moment off as long as possible. There was a stir among the Shinarans, men getting to their feet. Rand was coming out of Moraine's hut. Even at that distance, Perrin could make him out clearly, a young man with reddish hair and gray eyes. He was of an age with Perrin, and would stand half a head taller if they were side by side, though Rand was more slender, if still broad across the shoulders. Embroidered golden thorns ran up the sleeves of his high-collared red coat, and on the breast of his dark cloak stood the same creature as on the banner, the four-legged serpent with the golden mane. Rand and he had grown up together as friends.
Are we still friends? Can we be, now?
The Shinarans bowed as one, heads held up but hands to knees.
Lord Dragon, Uno called. We stand ready. Honor to serve.
Uno, who could hardly say a sentence without a curse, spoke now with the deepest respect. The others echoed him.
Honor to serve.
Massima, who saw ill in everything, and whose eyes now shone with utter devotion. Ragan. All of them awaiting a command, if it were Rand's pleasure to give one. From the slope, Rand stared down at them a moment, then turned and disappeared into the trees.
He has been arguing with Moraine again, Min said quietly. All day, this time.
Perrin was not surprised, yet he still felt a small shock. Arguing with an Aes Sedai. All the childhood tales came back to him. Aes Sedai, who made thrones and nations dance to their hidden strings. Aes Sedai, whose gift always had a hook in it, whose price was always smaller than you could believe, yet always turned out to be greater than you could imagine. Aes Sedai, whose anger could break the ground and summon lightning. Some of the stories were untrue, he knew now, and at the same time they did not tell the half.
I had better go to him, he said. After they argue, he always needs someone to talk to.
And aside from Moraine and Lan, there were only the three of them, Min, Loyal, and him, who did not stare at Rand as if he stood above kings. And of the three, only Perrin knew him from before. He strode up the slope, pausing only to glance at the closed door of Moraine's hut. Leah would be in there, and Lan. The warder seldom let himself get far from the Aes Sedai's side. Rand's much smaller hut was a little lower down, well hidden in the trees, away from all the rest. He had tried living down among the other men, but their constant awe drove him off. He kept to himself now, too much to himself to Perrin's thinking. But he knew Rand was not headed to his hut now. Perrin hurried on to where one side of the bull-shaped valley suddenly became sheer cliff, 50 paces high and smooth, except for tough brush clinging tenaciously here and there. He knew exactly where a crack in the gray wall lay, an opening hardly wider than his shoulders. With only a ribbon of late afternoon light overhead, it was like walking down a tunnel. Half a mile the crack ran, abruptly opening out into a narrow vale, less than a mile long, its floor covered with rocks and boulders, and even the steep slopes were thickly forested with tall leather leaf and pine and fir. Long shadows stretched away from the sun sitting on the mountaintops. The walls of this place were unbroken, save for the crack, and as steep as if a giant axe had buried itself in the mountains. It could be even more easily defended by a few than the bowl, but it had neither stream nor spring. No one went there, except Rand, after he argued with Moraine. Rand stood not far from the entrance, leaning against the rough trunk of a leather leaf, staring at the palms of his hands. Perrin knew that on each there was a heron, branded into the flesh. Rand did not move when Perrin's boot scraped on stone. Suddenly Rand began to recite softly, never looking up from his hands.
Twice and twice shall he be marked, twice to live and twice to die. Once the heron to set his path,
twice the heron to name him true. Once the dragon for remembrance lost, twice the dragon for the price he must pay. With a shudder, he tucked his hands under his arms. But no dragons yet, he chuckled roughly. Not yet. For a moment, Perrin simply looked at him. A man who could channel the one power. A man doomed to go mad from the taint on Saidin, the male half of the true source, and certain to destroy everything around him in his madness. A man, a thing, everyone was taught to loathe and fear from childhood. Only, it was hard to stop seeing the boy he had grown up with. How do you just stop being somebody's friend? Perrin chose a small boulder with a flat top and sat waiting. After a while, Rand turned his head to look at him. Do you think Matt is all right? He looked so sick the last time I saw him. He must be all right by now. He should be in Tarvalen by now. They'll heal him there. And Nynaeve and Egwene will keep him out of trouble. Egwene and Nynaeve, Rand and Matt and Perrin. All five from Emmons Field and the Two Rivers. Few people had come into the Two Rivers from outside, except for occasional peddlers and merchants once a year to buy wool and tobacco. Almost no one had ever left. Until the wheel chose out its Taviren, and five simple country folk could stay where they were no longer. Could be what they had been no longer. Rand nodded and was silent. Lately, Perrin said, I find myself wishing I was still a blacksmith. Do you wish you were still just a shepherd? Duty, Rand muttered. Death is lighter than a feather, duty heavier than a mountain. That's what they say in Shinar. The Dark One is stirring, the last battle is coming, and the dragon reborn has to face the Dark One in the last battle, or the shadow will cover everything. The wheel of time broken. Every age remade in the Dark One's image. There's only me. He began to laugh mirthlessly, his shoulders shaking. I have the duty because there isn't anybody else now, is there? Perrin shifted uneasily. The laughter had a raw edge that made his skin crawl. I understand you were arguing with Moraine again. The same thing? Rand drew a deep, ragged breath. Don't we always argue about the same thing? They're down there, on Almuth Plain, and the light alone knows where else. Hundreds of them. Thousands. They declared for the dragon reborn because I raised that banner. Because I let myself be called the dragon. Because I could see no other choice. And they're dying. Fighting, searching, and praying for the man who was supposed to lead them. Dying. And I sit here safe in the mountains all winter. I owe them something. You think I like it? Perrin swung his head in irritation. You take whatever she says to you, Rand grated. You never stand up to her. Much good it has done you, standing up to her. You have argued all winter, and we have sat here like lumps all winter. Because she is right. Rand laughed again, that chilling laugh. The light burned me, she is right. They are all split up into little groups all over the plain. All across Taraban and Ar-Domhan. If I join any one of them, the White Cloaks and the Domani army and the Tarabanners will be on top of them like a duck on a beetle. Perrin almost laughed himself in confusion. If you agree with her, why in the light do you argue all the time? Because I have to do something, or I'll burst like a rotted melon. Do what? If you listen to what she says...
Rand gave him no chance to say they would sit there forever.
Moraine says! Rand jerked erect, squeezing his head between his hands. Moraine has something to say about everything. Moraine says I mustn't go to the men who are dying in my name. Moraine says I'll know what to do next because the pattern will force me to it. Moraine says! But she never says how I'll know. Oh no, she doesn't know that!
His hands fell to his sides and he turned toward Perrin, head tilted and eyes narrowed.
Sometimes I feel as if Moraine is putting me through my paces like a fancy Tyran stallion, doing his steps. Do you ever feel that?
Perrin scrubbed a hand through his shaggy hair.
I...
Whatever is pushing us or pulling us, I know who the enemy is, Rand.
Balzamon, Rand said softly.
An ancient name for the Dark One. In the Trolloc tongue, it meant Heart of the Dark.
And I must face him, Perrin.
His eyes closed in a grimace, half smile, half pain.
Light help me.
Half the time I want it to happen now, to be over and done with, and the other half... How many times can I manage to...
Light, it pulls at me so.
What if I can't... What if I...
The ground trembled.
Rand?
Perrin said worriedly. Rand shivered. Despite the chill, there was sweat on his face. His eyes were still shut tight.
Oh, Light, he groaned. It pulls so.
Suddenly the ground heaved beneath Perrin and the valley echoed with a vast rumble. It seemed as if the ground was jerked out from under his feet. He fell, or the earth leaped up to meet him. The valley shook as though a vast hand had reached down from the sky to wrench it out of the land. He clung to the ground while it tried to bounce him like a ball. Pebbles in front of his eyes leaped and tumbled, and dust rose in waves.
Rand!
His bellow was lost in the grumbling roar. Rand stood with his head thrown back, his eyes still shut tight. He did not seem to feel the thrashing of the ground that had him now at one angle, now at another. His balance never shifted, no matter how he was tossed. Perrin could not be certain, being shaken as he was, but he thought Rand wore a sad smile. The trees flailed about, and the leatherleaf suddenly cracked in two, the greater part of its trunk crashing down not 3 paces from Rand. He noticed it no more than he noticed any of the rest. Perrin struggled to fill his lungs.
Rand, for the love of the light, Rand, stop it!
As abruptly as it had begun, it was done. A weakened branch cracked off of a stunted oak with a loud snap. Perrin got to his feet slowly, coughing. Dust hung in the air, sparkling motes in the rays of the setting sun. Rand was staring at nothing now, chest heaving as if he had run 10 miles. This had never happened before, nor anything remotely like it.
Rand, Perrin said carefully, what?
Rand still seemed to be looking into a far distance.
It is always there, calling to me, pulling at me. Sidene, the male half of the true source. Sometimes I can't stop myself from reaching out for it.
He made a motion of plucking something out of the air and transferred his stare to his closed fist.
I can feel the taint even before I touch it. The Dark One's taint, like a thin coat of vileness trying to hide the light. It turns my stomach, but I cannot help myself. I cannot! Only sometimes I reach out and it's like trying to catch air.
His empty hand sprang open and he gave a bitter laugh.
What if that happens when the last battle comes? What if I reach out and catch nothing?
Well, you caught something that time, Perrin said hoarsely.
What were you doing?
Rand looked around as if seeing things for the first time. The fallen leather leaf and the broken branches. There was, Perrin realized, surprisingly little damage. He had expected gaping rents in the earth. The wall of trees looked almost whole.
I did not mean to do this.
It was as if I tried to open a tap and instead pulled the whole tap out of the barrel.
It filled me. I had to send it somewhere before it burned me up, but I did not mean this.
Perrin shook his head. What use to tell him to try not to do it again? He barely knows more about what he's doing than I do. He contented himself with,
there are enough who want you dead, and the rest of us, without you doing the job for them.
Rand did not seem to be listening.
We had best get on back to the camp. It will be dark soon, and I don't know about you, but I'm hungry.
What? Oh, you go on, Perrin. I will be along. I want to be alone again a while.
Perrin hesitated, then turned reluctantly toward the crack in the valley wall. He stopped when Rand spoke again.
Do you have dreams when you sleep? Good dreams?
Sometimes, Perrin said warily. I don't remember much of what I dream.
He had learned to set guards on his dreaming.
There are always dreams, Rand said, so softly Perrin barely heard. Maybe they tell us things, true things.
He fell silent, brooding. Supper's waiting, Perrin said, but Rand was deep in his own thoughts. Finally, Perrin turned and left him standing there.
Chapter 3. News from the Plain. Darkness shrouded part of the crack, for in one place the tremors had collapsed a part of the wall against the other side, high up. He stared up at the blackness warily before hurrying underneath, but the slab of stone seemed to be solidly wedged in place. The itch had returned to the back of his head, stronger than before.
No, burn me, no!
It went away.
When he came out above the camp, the bowl was filled with odd shadows from the sinking sun. Moraine was standing outside her hut, peering up at the crack. He stopped short. She was a slender, dark-haired woman, no taller than his shoulder, and pretty, with the ageless quality of all Aes Sedai who had worked with the One Power for a time. He could not put any age at all to her, with her face too smooth for many years and her dark eyes too wise for youth. Her dress of deep blue silk was disarrayed and dusty, and wisps stuck out in her usually well-ordered hair. A smudge of dust lay across her face. He dropped his eyes. She knew about him, she and Lan alone, of those in the camp, and he did not like the knowing in her face when she looked into his eyes. Yellow eyes. Someday, perhaps, he could bring himself to ask her what she knew. An Aes Sedai must know more of it than he did, but this was not the time. There never seemed to be a time. He didn't mean. It was an accident.
An accident, she said in a flat voice, then shook her head and vanished back inside the hut.
The door banged shut a little loudly. Perrin drew a deep breath and continued on down toward the cook fires. There would be another argument between Rand and the Aes Sedai in the morning, if not tonight. Half a dozen trees lay toppled on the slopes of the bowl, roots ripped out of the earth in arcs of soil. A trail of scrapes and churned ground led down to the stream side in a boulder that had not been there before. One of the huts up the opposite slope had collapsed in the tremors, and most of the Shinarans were gathered around it, rebuilding it. Loyal was with them. The Ogier could pick up a log it would take 4 men to lift. Uno's curses occasionally drifted down. Min stood by the fires, stirring a kettle with a disgruntled expression. There was a small bruise on her cheek, and a faint smell of burned stew hung in the air.
I hate cooking, she announced,
and peered doubtfully into the kettle.
If something goes wrong with it, it isn't my fault. Rand spilled half of it on the fire with his... What right does he have to bounce us around like sacks of grain?
She rubbed the seat of her breeches and winced.
When I get my hands on him, I'll thump him so he never forgets.
She waved the wooden spoon at Perrin as if she intended to start the thumping with him.
Was anyone hurt?
Only if you count bruises, Min said grimly.
They were upset all right, at first. Then they saw Moraine staring off toward Rand's hidey-hole and decided it was his work.
If the dragon wants to shake the mountain down on our heads, then the dragon must have a good reason for it. If he decided to make them take off their skins and dance in their bones, they would think it all right.
She snorted and rapped the spoon on the edge of the kettle. He looked back toward Moraine's hut. If Leah had been hurt, if she were dead, the Aes Sedai would not simply have gone back inside. The sense of waiting was still there.
Whatever it is, it hasn't happened yet. Min, maybe you had better go. First thing in the morning.
I have some silver I can let you have, and I'm sure Moraine would give you enough to take passage with a merchant's train out of Giladon. You could be back in Bairlum before you know it. She looked at him until he began to wonder if he had said something wrong. Finally she said,
That is very sweet of you, Perrin, but no. I thought you wanted to go. You're always carrying on about having to stay here.
I knew an Ilianar woman once, she said slowly. When she was young,
Her mother arranged a marriage for her with a man she had never even met. They do that down in Ilion sometimes. She said she spent the first 5 years raging against him, and the next 5 scheming to make his life miserable without his knowing who was to blame. It was only years later, she said, when he died, that she realized he really had been the love of her life. I don't see what that has to do with this. Her look said he obviously was not trying to understand, and her voice became overly patient. Just because fate has chosen something for you instead of you choosing it for yourself doesn't mean it has to be bad, even if it's something you are sure you would never have chosen in 100 years. Better 10 days of love than years of regretting, she quoted. I understand that even less, he told her. You don't have to stay if you don't want to. She hung the spoon on a tall forked stick stuck in the ground, then surprised him by rising on tiptoe to kiss his cheek. You are a very nice man, Perrin Ebarra, even if you don't understand anything. Perrin blinked at her uncertainly. He wished that he could be certain Rand was in his right mind or that Matt were there. He was never sure of his ground with girls, but Rand always seemed to know his way. So did Matt. Most of the girls back home in Emmonsfield had sniffed that Matt would never grow up, but he had seemed to have a way with them. What about you, Perrin? Don't you ever want to go home? All the time, he said fervently. But I do not think I can. Not yet. He looked off toward Rand's Vale. We are tied together, it seems, aren't we, Rand? Maybe not ever. He thought he had said that too softly for her to hear, but the look she gave him was full of sympathy and agreement. His ears caught faint footsteps behind him, and he looked back up toward Moraine's hut. 2 shapes were making their way down through the deepening twilight, one a woman, slender and graceful, even on the rough, slanting ground. The man, head and shoulders taller than his companion, turned off toward where the Shinarans were working. Even to Perrin's eyes, he was indistinct, sometimes seeming to vanish altogether, then appear in mid-stride, parts of him fading into the night and fading back as the wind gusted. Only a warder's shifting cloak could do that, which made the larger figure Lan, just as the smaller was certainly Moraine. Well behind them, another shape, even dimmer, slipped behind the trees. Rand, Perrin thought, going back to his hut. Another night when he won't eat because he can't stand the way everybody looks at him. You must have eyes in the back of your head, Min said, frowning toward the approaching woman, or else the sharpest ears I've ever heard. Is that Moraine? Careless. He had grown so used to the Shinarans knowing how well he could see, in daylight at least, they did not know about the night, that he was beginning to slip about other things. Carelessness might kill me yet. Is the Tuathuan woman all right? Min asked as Moraine came to the fire. She is resting. The Aes Sedai's low voice had its usual musical quality, as if speaking were halfway to singing, and her hair and clothes were back in perfect order again. She rubbed her hands over the fire. There was a golden ring on her left hand, a serpent biting its own tail. The Great Serpent, an even older symbol for eternity than the Wheel of Time. Every woman trained in Tarvalen wore such a ring. For a moment, Moraine's gaze rested on Perrin and seemed to penetrate too deeply. She fell and split her scalp when Rand... Her mouth tightened, but in the next instant, her face was utter calm again. I healed her, and she is sleeping. There is always a good deal of blood, with even a minor scalp wound, but it was not serious. Did you see anything about her, Min? Min looked uncertain. I thought I saw her death. Her own face, all over blood. I was sure I knew what it meant, but if she split her scalp, are you sure she is all right? It was a measure of her discomfort that she asked. An Aes Sedai did not heal and leave anything wrong that could be healed, and Moraine's talents were particularly strong in that area.
Min sounded so troubled that Perrin was surprised for a moment. Then he nodded to himself. She did not really like doing what she did, but it was a part of her. She thought she knew how it worked, or some of it at least. If she was wrong, it would almost be like finding out she did not know how to use her own hands. Moraine considered her for a moment, serene and dispassionate.
You have never been wrong in any reading for me. Not one about which I had any way of knowing. Perhaps this is the first time.
When I know, I know, Min whispered obstinately. Light help me, I do.
Or perhaps it is yet to come. She has a long way yet to travel, to return to her wagons, and she must ride through unsettled lands.
The Aes Sedai's voice was a cool song, uncaring. Perrin made an involuntary sound in his throat.
Light. Did I sound like that? I won't let a death matter that little to me.
As if he had spoken out loud, Moraine looked at him.
The wheel weaves as the wheel wills, Perrin. I told you long ago that we were in a war. We cannot stop just because some of us may die. Any of us may die before it is done. Leah's weapons may not be the same as yours, but she knew that when she became part of it.
Perrin dropped his eyes.
That's as may be, Aes Sedai, but I will never accept it the way you do.
Lan joined them across the fire with Uno and Loyal. The flames cast flickering shadows across the warder's face, making it seem more carved from stone even than it normally did, all hard planes and angles. His cloak was not much easier to look at in the firelight. Sometimes it seemed only a dark gray cloak or black, but the gray and black appeared to crawl and change if you looked too closely, shapes and shadows sliding across it, soaking into it. Other times it looked as if Lan had somehow made a hole in the night and pulled darkness round his shoulders. Not at all an easy thing to watch, and not made any easier by the man who wore it. Lan was tall and hard, broad-shouldered, with blue eyes like frozen mountain lakes, and he moved with a deadly grace that made the sword on his hip seem a part of him. It was not that he seemed merely capable of violence and death. This man had tamed violence and death and kept them in his pocket, ready to be loosed in a heartbeat, or embraced, should Moraine give the word. Beside Lan, even Uno appeared less dangerous. There was a touch of gray in the warder's long hair, held back by a woven leather cord around his forehead. But younger men stepped back from confronting Lan, if they were wise.
Mistress Leah has the usual news from Almuth Plain, Moraine said. Everyone fighting everyone else. Villages burned, people fleeing in every direction. And hunters have appeared in the plain, searching for the Horn of Valier.
Perrin shifted. The horn was where no hunter on Almuth Plain would find it, where he hoped no hunter ever would find it. And she gave him a cool look before continuing. She did not like any of them to speak of the horn, except when she chose to, of course.
She brought different news as well. The White Cloaks have perhaps 5,000 men on Almuth Plain.
Uno grunted.
That's flamin'. Pardon, Aes Sedai. That must be half their strength. They've never committed so much to one place before.
Then I suppose all those who declared for Rand are dead or scattered, Perrin muttered. Or they soon will be. You are right, Moraine. He did not like the thought of White Cloaks. He did not like the Children of the Light at all.
That is what is odd, Moraine said, or the first part of it. The Children have announced that their purpose is to bring peace, which is not unusual for them. What is unusual is that while they are trying to force the Tarabonners and the Domani back across their respective borders, they have not moved in any force against those who have declared for the dragon.
Min gave an exclamation of surprise.
Is she certain? That does not sound like any White Cloaks I ever heard of.
There can't be many tinkers left on the plain, Uno said.
His voice creaked from the strain of watching his language in front of an Aes Sedai. His real eye matched the frown of the painted one.
They don't like to stay where there's any kind of trouble, especially fighting.
There can't be enough of them to see everywhere.
There are enough for my purposes, Moraine said firmly. Most have gone, but some few remained because I asked them to. And Leah is quite certain. Oh, the children have snapped up some of the dragon sworn, where there were only a handful gathered. But though they proclaim they will bring down this false dragon, though they have 1,000 men supposedly doing nothing but hunting him, they avoid contact with any party of as many as 50 dragon sworn. Not openly, you understand, but there is always some delay, something that allows those they chase to slip away.
Then Rand can go down to them as he wants.
Loyal blinked uncertainly at the Aes Sedai. The whole camp knew of her arguments with Rand.
The wheel weaves away for him.
Uno and Lan opened their mouths at the same time, but the Shinaran gave way with a small bow.
More likely, the warder said, it is some white cloak plot, though the light burn me if I can see what it is. But when the white cloaks give me a gift, I search for the poison needle hidden in it.
Uno nodded grimly.
Besides which, Lan added, the Damani and the Taraboners are still trying as hard to kill the dragon sworn as they are to kill each other.
And there is another thing, Moraine said. 3 young men have died in villages Mistress Leah's wagons passed near.
Perrin noticed a flicker of Lan's eyelid. For the warder, it was as much a sign of surprise as a shout from another man. Lan had not expected her to tell this. Moraine went on.
One died by poison, 2 by the knife. Each in circumstances where no one should have been able to come close unseen. But that is how it happened.
She peered into the flames.
All 3 young men were taller than most and had light-colored eyes. Light eyes are uncommon on Almuth Plain. But I think it is very unlucky right now to be a tall young man with light eyes there.
How? Perrin asked. How could they be killed if no one could get close to them?
The Dark One has killers you don't notice until it is too late, Lan said quietly. Uno gave a shiver.
A soulless. I never heard of one south of the Borderlands before.
Enough of such talk, Moraine said firmly.
Perrin had questions.
What in the light are the soulless? Are they like a Trolloc or a Fade? What?
But he left them unasked. When Moraine decided enough had been said about something, she would not talk of it any more. And when she shut her mouth, you could not pry lands open with an iron bar. The Shinarans followed her lead, too. No one wanted to anger an Aes Sedai.
Light, Min muttered, uneasily eyeing the deepening darkness around them. You don't notice them? Light.
So nothing has changed, Perrin said glumly. Not really. We cannot go down to the plain, and the Dark One wants us dead.
Everything changes, Moraine said calmly, and the pattern takes it all in. We must ride on the pattern, not on the changes of a moment.
She looked at them each in turn, then said,
Uno, are you certain your scouts missed nothing suspicious, even something small?
The Lord Dragon's rebirth has loosed the bonds of certainty, Moraine Sedai, and there is never certainty if you fight Murdral. But I will stake my life that the scouts did as good a job as any warder.
It was one of the longest speeches Perrin had ever heard out of Uno without any curses. There was sweat on the man's forehead from the effort.
We all may, Moraine said. What Rand did might as well have been a fire on the mountaintop for any Murdral within 10 miles. Maybe, Min began hesitantly, maybe you ought to set wards that will keep them out.
Lan gave her a hard stare. He sometimes questioned Moraine's decisions himself, though he seldom did so or anyone could overhear. But he did not approve of others doing the same. Min frowned right back at him.
Well, Murdral and Trollocs are bad enough, but at least I can see them. I don't like the idea that one of these soulless might sneak in here and slit my throat before I even noticed him. The wards I set will hide us from the soulless as well as from any other shadow spawn, Moraine said. When you are weak, as we are, the best choice is often to hide. if there is a half-man close enough to have... well, to set wards that would kill them if they tried to enter camp is beyond my...